came here planning to talk to you with my associate, Dr. Kasperzak, about some unique aspects of the Veterans Administration, but I cannot initiate that talk against the background of what's been stated. We have a big problem in this country, and I don't feel that perpetuating the concept of charity care meets that requirement. Someday, I would hope, we won't have charity care. We'll have health care for everybody. I spent a year in the National Health Service when I was just a young doctor because I was concerned about these issues. And I came back to this country and realized that that would be a long way off. Remember, during the bombings in England, all during the war, especially London, if you were injured, you got health care. Nobody asked you whether you had Blue Shield or Medicare. So it was easy for the British to segue into a health care system. I will make some comments. First of all, the first comment is that nothing that I say or Dr. Kasperzak, who follows me, says represents the VA. We do work in the Veterans Administration, but our comments are personal. The focus of my comments and Dr. Kasperzak's is to bring to your attention and others that the Veterans Administration is an evolving healthcare system. For many of us, it's been inexplicable that we ventured in the past 18 months to revive the healthcare system in our country, but the VA had a system right there that was functioning and could have been modified and still can be to meet the needs that have been so well articulated from this platform today. The focus is that the VA hospitals, there's about 150, but some of them are very sophisticated, could well become centers for medical education, medical school. So it would be a VA hospital / medical school. I'll introduce you some history of the VA that shows its flexibility. And I'll also mention some of the items that make it want to change. I'm supposed to tell you I have no relationships, but I am married. Back in the 1600s, it would not be uncommon to find on a tree post, in case necessity required to send forces, they had to fight the Indians, that if any returns maimed, that's the way it was spelled, and hurt, he shall be maintained completely by the colony during his life. So the care of the wounded soldier was something that carried over even into the Continental Congress. The care of the wounded soldier was primarily the responsibility of the state, the community, and finally the federal government. But all of that care was not what we think of as care. None of it was restorative. The wounded soldier was disabled for life, and he was provided by the authorities with some custodial care. The bottom of this slide, the disabled indigent of the Civil War, the Indian Wars, the War of 1812, the Spanish-American War, Mexican Border War, all of them were housed, warehoused, until at the turn of 1900, by the time we entered World War I, medical care had become sophisticated enough so that we could start talking about rehabilitating people and returning them to normal life. In 1920, Congress authorized the U.S. Public Health Service to build 46 additional to its then 22 hospitals. for World War I injured, so he began sophisticated medical care offering a possibility of recovery. Just giving you a background of how healthcare in the veterans' atmosphere has evolved. Reflecting on the VA's flexibility and bringing to your attention what we think is the next step, namely entering and involving itself in medical education. There were three federal organizations available in 1920, the National Home for the Disabled, Bureau of Pensions, Veterans Bureau, they were all combined in 1930, and the word Veterans Administration was born. The way we now practice in the Veterans Administration is very much based on what happened in the terminal days of World War II. As it was grinding to a halt, we had 98 VA hospitals, 63,000 beds. Big VA hospitals like Palo Alto had 1,000 beds, 5 doctors. At that time, there were no residents in training in any VA hospitals. Facing this return of thousands of injured GIs, President Truman turned to General Omar Bradley, who was in charge of the Veterans Administration, who in turn turned to the Chief of Orthopedics, Paul Magnusson, who invented what we now have. Community hospitals around the country were welcoming back their many doctors who had been in service, but there were too few patients to support them. On the other hand, down the street was a Veterans Administration hospital, just the reverse. I showed you. Too many patients, too few doctors. He persuaded Truman to support a staff of VAs using part-time selected physicians from the local medical schools and universities and from the local communities. Two laws were implemented. One was a law, one a memorandum. Within hours of approval of the concept of using that population by going to the deans of the medical school and the deans of the universities that were involved and the local community, VA selected medical school deans and their residents, selected medical staff and their residents were streaming into VA hospitals across the country. The public law 293 facilitated hiring and bypassing all the traditional delays that takes place in any kind of bureaucratic selection of staff, which can go on for months. Memorandum number 2 is very important. It reads, and it's still referred to, the Veteran Administration retains full responsibility for the care of patients, and the schools of medicine accept responsibility for all graduate education and training. The VA medical school affiliation blossomed. Even today, 70% of practicing American physicians boast of having had a meaningful part of their training in a VA facility. Of our current 127 medical schools, 102 utilize the VA for part of the training of their staff. University academics, on the other hand, also boasted their VA relationship. They took note of the VA space and equipment for research, the opportunity for VA research funding, and the likelihood that VA patients would agree to participate in their research. These attributes are not easily available in any part of the private sector. VA hospitals in the early days after World War II were filled with veteran wounded. But soon, they were taken care of, and there were empty beds. And we had homeless, impoverished veterans with illness, and it was recognized they deserved care. And so if there were available beds, after all patients with service-connected disorders had been treated, it was okay for the hospital to include those patients. In 1954, I worked in a VA hospital for a year in Chicago, and it was like working in a city hospital where I had worked as a medical student. Most of the patients were charitable patients but they had served. They were also patients who were sick. That's important because I'm going to point out later that the VA now is preventing sickness. At that time, for the impoverished, they were providing, and the sick, they were providing care. All the veterans became soon welcome in the VA. At the turn of the century, this century, elderly veterans who had money began to face increasing drug costs and sought entry into VA. When you become a member of the VA, even now, you get your drug care is either zero or there's a small equivalent copay that you would have had to pay if you had private insurance. So impoverished veterans had already been accepted. About 2000, in the year 2000, Congress provided access for those of means. They were to be assessed a copay charge equivalent to the copay they would have paid with private health insurance, and today's VA was reborn, first evidence of its flexibility. Then came Vietnam and the anti-government spirit. Newspaper headlines read third-rate medicine for first-rate men. Gossip was prevalent that some VA part-time physicians coming from the medical schools received a salary but were never on the VA campus. Books were published like Martin Cantor's Uncle Sam's Shame, Inside Our Broken VA. Movies, Born on the 4th of July, which I saw as a young person, an amputee, he was in the Bronx VA. They had no equipment for amputation patients. The VA medical school relationship was challenged. In 1992, the Institute of Health, Institute of Medicine, was asked by the VA leadership to assemble a select group of non-VA medical leaders to evaluate the true impact of the VA medical school affiliation. The affiliation, remember, started in 1945. This is 1992. That committee studied its problem. It timed how long it took a resident to examine a patient, how long it took a grown doctor. They sought to determine if the relationship the VA to medical school was an even exchange, was the VA being taken advantage. They found out that the affiliation was worthwhile. If there was a disaffiliation, it would cause problem, staff would leave the VA. Some residency programs would close, research would grind to a halt. In the 20 years since, there's been a dramatic evolution to today's new VA, more evidence of flexibility. Patient satisfaction has skyrocketed. It's measured all the time. New books like Philip Longman's Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare is Better Than Yours. The VA has received international accolade for pioneering and perfecting electronic medical records, for developing a system for measuring quality of surgical care called the National Surgery Quality Improvement Program. As a nurse in each hospital, tracks every operative patient, compares their comorbidities, and then calculates what result should be. And those figures being made available, am I over my time? There are other aspects of the VA that are unique. The way its drug program works, the formulary, selecting drugs that do the job, cost less, purchasing in large numbers. Initially, the medical school academics came to the VA with their third and fourth year students. More recently, they haven't had the time. The same reason they don't vote. And what's happened is they've sent the students over, and the VA staff has done the teaching for third and fourth year students. There was another survey done in 2006 that looked at the system. It didn't make any positive suggestions. And that brings us to the most important issue, which is the shortage of primary care physicians. The average medical school graduate has a burden, financial burden, of $150,000 to $200,000 on graduation. He looks around, she looks around, half of them are women today, and they see the primary care physicians earn half of what the specialists do. The percent of students going into primary care from medical schools has dropped from 30% to 17% in the last decade. They join the VA, they would be exposed to primary care physicians across the board. Every VA patient has a VA doctor, primary care doctor, who is responsible for that patient and refers them to the specialist. So, I only have three slides left. For the student, after 4 years, if the medical school was part of the VA, and for the student, it would be less costly indebtedness. It may not be zero, there may be a charge, but it would be much less. After 4 years, they would have learned how to, they would have mastered the electronic medical record, they'd understand the value of a drug formulary, which guides economical and effective drugs. They would be exposed to primary care doctors for 4 years who manage the patient, are not the butt of disparaging remarks by colleagues, and have a wide breadth of knowledge which is respected. After 4 years, they know about the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program, which shows how good the VA has done. After the 4 years, the country would have benefited. We'd have more graduates in primary care, more people applying to work in the VA. The VA would have moved from serving only the wounded and sick, providing preventive and therapeutic care to all who have served, and Schockett thinks it could be broadened to the whole country with the proper steps. It does so at a high professional level and economically. We propose the VA share these techniques with aspiring new generation of physicians using the VA's 152 hospitals, and don't have to use all, and 800 community centers. Thank you, and I'll introduce